I'm Bob Franklin. Thanks very much for joining me. This is Like It Is. Today, Kim Davis of Kim & Company, located in Montgomery, Alabama, has an interesting conversation with two designing sisters. They are friends and they are designing sister friends. That's the bond between two African-American interior designers who share a love for their businesses and their sisterhood. They met in a most unusual way, a way that continues to bring them and their work together. Stephanie and Robin share their designing sisters' story today on Talking with Kim One-on-One.
Stephanie Coley and Robin Myers are African-American female interior designers and business owners who simply love what they do. They plan, research, sell, cultivate beauty, harmony, and order. Robin calls it your prescription for better living, physically, emotionally, and aesthetically. Stephanie will tell you she takes a holistic-based focus to designing and building all things beautifully sustainable and awesomely new. Together as friends, business associates, collaborators, and design sisters, their work revolves around inspiring everything and everyone they touch every day. And every time I talk with them, I get inspired to find something new that brings balance and harmony to my life, even if it's simply buying a beautiful new rug for my garage. So, Stephanie and Robin, welcome to Talking with Kim One-on-One. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Kim. Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining me today. It's been a pleasure, ladies, I must say, in getting to know you both over these past several months. And I thank you for welcoming me into your businesses as interior designers. What does that mean to the both of you? And let's start by introducing your business name and your businesses and where you're located. Let's start there.
I'm Robin Harmon Myers. My business is Harmony Designs Furniture and Interiors. I established it in 2003. We incorporated and located in Mount Vernon, New York.
Yeah, this is Stephanie Coley, and I am a certified registered interior designer. I practice in Alabama, Georgia, and Louisiana. The name of my company is Scenario Design, Inc., and I am primarily located in central Alabama, Alexander City, Lake Martin area.
And ladies, tell us, how did you meet? Because I do understand there is a certain person who you both know who really kind of brought you both together.
Yeah, that would be my husband, Floyd. Floyd is, he's a business manager with the National Park Service, and he was doing a detail in Alabama and needed some interior design work or some type of work, that he linked up with Stephanie. And truthfully, his friends become my friends. And Stephanie was kind enough to work with us on a property in Maryland on the Eastern Shore. And her talent, her personality, we just became friends. And so, yeah, that's the link, Mr. Floyd Myers, my husband.
That's pretty much it in a nutshell. Floyd and I hit it off immediately when we were working on something that he was dealing with the Park Service history. We were talking about post-slavery and dialogue on race. And we began to talk, and there was, you know, the connections. And it's been great. They're wonderful and special friends.
And so as you all continue to connect and talk and collaborate, what has building this relationship together meant to the both of you? First of all, as friends, and then secondly, as design sisters, because you all share gifts together, you share talents together, you share opportunities to build upon your successes together.
Well, I'll go first on that. You know, the kindredness that we share, both in work as well as just in our general energies, has been a welcomed experience for me across the board. So I feel like, it's a natural extension. It's not a forced relationship. We're comfortable, calm, and we understand on more levels than most people will understand. So that becomes very important for me.
Yeah, you can get into your career, your industry, and your work cycle. And for me, a bit of a conundrum. I tend as an artist to, head down and I'm just doing my thing. But I found myself not opening up to enough relationships and cultivating them. And what I love about this moment in my life and my career is that I am opening up a lot more to cultivating relationships like anything else. They require attention and time, and it's just been great because Stephanie is talented, she's smart, and she's just, good, what we call good people. So it's been really fun exploring all the different ways and all the different things that we can do together, how our interests intersect. It's been great. It's really fun.
Robin, you used an interesting word there, and that word was artist. Do you both consider yourselves to be artists in what you do in your professions?
Well, I think we're all artists as human beings. We come from a creator, and all we do is create all the time. And whether you're a teacher, whether you're a sanitation worker, we're all artists, and I believe that really strongly. And I think when we tap into that truth, our life becomes more alive as we do what we're meant to be here to do, and that's create.
Absolutely. Artistry is an innate talent. And so if we are open to it, we can see it in many different ways in our life and lifestyles and what we project onto the community itself. So if we're open, we can experience it more, but the rigidity and the rejection is what keeps you thinking, well, I can't do those things. Yes, you can. It takes an effort, and it sometimes takes a shedding, So I think it's really important to remember that we are talented in many, many ways. We're not talented in every way, but we are talented, and that creativity is necessary for ourselves as well as the ethos. It's out there. It's just,
I love Stephanie that you said we're not talented in every way. Like, that is a great thing. I think by design, the creator's design, it forces us to have to, work with other people who have different skill sets and different
Sure.
talents. We can do everything. We
And
really can
home,
style up.
at home, and know when it's not your lane, It's really very important. And I think that's great in interior design as well, because I explain to people all the time, there are over 109 different types of jobs you can have as an interior designer. And most people think, oh, it's just this. It's not. There's the length, width, depth, breadth, all of it is available to you if you can open your mind and your heart up to it.
So, ladies, do people really know what interior design is? And if not, so share with us, what is it that you do? Because it's more than just the end game. It's what goes along the way in getting there, especially when you're dealing with clients who want something, expect something, think they know what they want, and you all are there to navigate them through the process. So take us through that navigation. Tell us what you do. Help us understand that.
For me, first of all, interior design means, I think it does have a definite definition, but within that definition, there are perspectives and takes, different takes on it. For me, I find myself, analyze, just like any other profession, if you were to go to a coach, who's training you, if you would go to a doctor. You know, we collect data. We get to know the environment, the circumstance, the individuals, and then we write a prescription. And that's how I approach it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm there to understand the climate, to understand the environment, to understand the issues, the opportunities. And then the artistry comes in is just your own personal je ne sais quoi that no one else has. You know, that's your thumbprint. And that's what you can only you can bring to any project, any aspect of what you do. So that's kind of how I see it.
Yeah, I would concur with that. The key to it is knowing, you know, we come in and our jobs are related to the health, safety, and welfare. And welfare and health and safety mean many things in many different environments, as well as you know, the constraints of an environment. So a lot of times what people want is not always what they need, but we need to be able to figure out how to give them the right prescription to balance that. Even like she said, you know, it's like doctors, we're giving you a prescription based on what? Based on your needs, based on your wants, on your end results that you want, based on what's taking place. Mm-hmm. And also, what is the budget? That budget is a big thing, and people are like,
yes,
well, I want this and I want that, you know, and telling them the elements of design are important, and that we discover what is the width and depth, but at the same time we have to shrink it down to what is the environment, you know, what's the size of it, what's the limitations, what's the ingress and egress, you know, things like that. How do we function in that space? Where is the functionality? And then we can build the beauty.
You know, that's an interesting way you both ladies describe it. And for the layperson, I think we just want the end result to be beautiful. But along the way, there are just certain nuggets that just have to be in place that you all really take the client through for them to realize the harmony, for them to realize the beauty, and for them to realize the order of what you all want the end product to represent, right?
Yeah, you know, here's what I find educating, what I find myself really educating my clients and customers on, and that is process. Things don't just happen. Yes. Everything is by design. Mm-hmm. And once I'm passionate about educating my people. And so I'm always sharing how I'm coming to certain decisions and why. And it helps them understand, like, oh, it's not as simple as, you know, placing this here. I see, you know, once I do it, once I do this thing, then how it impacts other things. So it educates all of us once we understand that there's a process and there's a science to having an effective and a beautiful and an environment that is working well and sustaining whatever the activity is within that environment, whether it is a museum, whether it's a hospital, whether it's someone's home.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is designed and prescribed for a use. And then of course, it also has to inspire use.
Mm.
That's where the beauty comes in, and the making it inviting. That's, you know, that there are techniques to do that as well. But yeah, we learn that nothing just happens. We start to understand and appreciate the process.
Indeed, that's important. You know, good puzzle is fitly joined. And if you don't know what the elements and parts are and where they go, whether it's a 100-piece puzzle or a 1,000-piece puzzle, if you along the way are losing sight of what does and doesn't fit, you've lost the puzzle. You can't put it together. So, and I tell people all the time, yeah, you like this, but does it fit the puzzle? Does it, is that an element of where you're trying to go with this? and keeping them focused on that. You know, along the way, they see a lot of beautiful things. And every bit of beauty can't coexist, you know. So sometimes you have to take that and say, okay, well, that's great if I have four homes and I can divvy it up, but I can't put every single thing I've ever seen as beautiful in one space. The mind and the experience is gone, you know. It's just it's not fit.
Stephanie, I always joke and I say to the clients, I go, oh, that's for your summer home, or that's for your third home, and they start to get it. They're like, okay, so
Oh, go here. Yeah, it's
yeah.
hilarious.
Yeah.
It's
So,
hilarious.
you know, ladies, you all are laughing about clients who bring that to you, but you also help them solve things too, and I'm sure they appreciate that in hiring you for various projects that you all have done. So share with us some of the projects that just absolutely make you smile as you remember some of the ups and the downs and the personalities that wanted this and it didn't work. Talk about some of the success stories of the projects that instantly come to mind.
Yeah, I think that a lot of times people misunderstand, or have this thought about certain things. And I especially come into those with those issues come into play when I'm dealing with senior citizens. Senior citizens don't want to appear to be a senior citizen. They, you know, I'm still me. And so when you start talking about accessibility and ADA requirements and all these things, and they're like, I don't want to like an old lady house. I don't want to do that. And I'm like, no, I'm really just, you know, discussing with you the difference between whether or not you want to pull out or you want drawers or you want to bend down and get on your hands and knees and dig in that cabinet. That's literally the difference. I'm not, it won't appear to be that to the public. You know, you'll know that the ease of use is there. But if you're talking to them when you're, you know, when they're answering the questions, they're like, no, I don't want anything that has anything to do with ADA. I'll figure out how to step up. And you're like, well, there are a lot of ways to incorporate these things. You know, we can slowly ramp up your sidewalk to your door. You know, it doesn't have to look like it's a ramp, things like that. So it's a lot of, you know, the seniors are something. But again, even with that universal design, having a family to understand that if you're going to be here for 20 or 25 years, and right now you're 50 and you're trying, you're moving around still a little bit, you know, that doesn't mean that that's your future. Or what if someone breaks their leg? Or what if someone becomes it's not ambulatory. All those things being incorporated in universal design, which is still ADA, but they don't want to be told that, it's still beneficial to you in the end. It just looks more natural.
I think some of my most favorite co-collaborative projects are just when clients understand that there was more to it and that they were more to the project than they realized, and that when they yield an outcome that is not only beautiful but meaningful and supportive, those are the best projects for me. And that's, you know, that's how I approach most projects. And so clients are always getting a little bit more than what they bargain for, because I tend to open them up about different aspects that they really didn't consider. And then within that moment, there comes a moment where, you know, clients can relax. They know that I have their best interest, and that, you know, I can open them up to seeing beyond what maybe they had originally thought they were doing when they called me and said, "Hey, I need some help with my home or my office or my business that I'm branding."
And Robin, you added a component, a wellness component to your business. Talk about that and how did that come about?
I've always understood that
we are having a symbiotic relationship with our environment. We're shaping our environment, and our environment is shaping us. I grew up in rural Maryland Eastern Shore, very humbly, but my mother could take a space and make it home. And when I look back in photos, there's this mid-century modern kind of look. It was very clean. Now, mind you, we wallpapered for insulation. It was, you know, I remember helping my mother do things, and it was not just for aesthetics. It was also, you know, for other reasons. And being of African descent and having a strong social justice spirit, I wanted to inspire people that look like me to understand that you have everything you need, but we've got to begin to, you know, have a healing of ourselves and our communities. And that starts with, you know, our built environment, our homes, our spaces, what they look like, how they feed us. And so that's where the wellness component began to really kind of take shape. Now there's a whole, you know, there's biophilic design, there's all of, you know, these catchphrases, you know, force bathing and all of that. But the truth is, you know, these things have always been a part of, I would say, most indigenous cultures. Mm-hmm. And so it's about us reawakening to that, remembering who we are and what we have, and just really kind of leaning into it. And I feel like when I open up that portal, that remembering aspect to clients, they really embrace it, and they really begin to understand why a space is more than just a place to lay your head and go in and out of the door.
Well said. Well said. And Stephanie, talk about projects that you've had to work on and you enjoyed working on at the Pentagon.
Oh, I'm not going to say I enjoyed working with the Pentagon. I am not going to say that. You know, I ended up in D.C. Post-Katrina. I had been waiting for a security clearance because at one point I was supposed to be the designer of record for the new embassy in Iraq. And so since I was waiting for that, I decided, well, while we're displaced, I'll go ahead and travel to D.C. and get in place. So then I get there, and I'm friends of mine and new people that I did not know helped me. Oh, he brought back a memory of a person I love so much, and she since passed away. But, you know, I ended up in another firm, and in that firm, you know, we signed different things, whether it was the Pentagon, Blackboard, educational services, very large law firms where there are 300 seats, which is attorneys. But working with the Pentagon was a different animal because every single thing about their facilities and offices, whether it was on their main campus or in Pentagon City, was highly specialized. So you were not just working with clients, you were working with security teams. And so you had to be very thoughtful about it, and you had to deal with the energies of those men who really believed that any and everything they said was
men.
And they, you know, something else. So, you know, we had different types of power serve, you know, that we brought in. We couldn't do certain things because we couldn't allow strange things like the windows to be mic'd.
Ah, I see.
Very interesting from the outside, whether you can set a wave in. Their battle lines were very different, things like that. So it was a learning situation.
Sure.
But was the security aspect and their lack of knowledge, but their demand to be the one with the answers, that was very difficult for all of us, not just me. You know, you don't know this work, but you want to tell the contractor and the design team that you're going to do it this way. When you find it wrong, we're 40,000, $3,000. Having people to stay in their lane is a huge thing.
Sure.
But when you're dealing with people who have certain types of authority or want certain types of authority, you have those issues. So that's something, you know, when people say, well, what do you mean you need to use psychology? I say every single day. whether it's somebody with a little room that I'm doing or if it's a full-on facility, you have to know how to adapt and adjust and bring them along and receive what they're telling you in information, because you may not know all of the information. You know, you're gathering and scattering all at the same time.
Interesting. Ladies, you know, we are out of time. We're absolutely out of time. To be continued. So I want to thank you both, Robin Myers, Stephanie Coley, for joining me today, talking with Kim one-on-one. To be continued. Ladies, yes. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure.
Thank you for inviting us. Thank you.
Thank you, too.
Kim Davis provided reporting for this Like It Is segment. Next week, Charlene Wexler, who is the author of the novel Murder on Skid Row, will join me. Based on a true story, Murder on Skid Row is the first novel by Charlene Wexler. Murder on Skid Row takes the reader back to a place that was an integral part of Chicago for decades, but one today's public officials would rather Chicago residents forget. Here's an excerpt from our discussion.
And we knew two pharmacists were killed in a crazy manner, one right after the other with a, it was just a crazy manner. They found the kid who did the murders, but it was more who hired him that was important. And my husband knew about this, and he was a dentist, and he tried to open an office in Skid Row, which was right near the University of Illinois. He thought he would help the people. He was young and that he could help the people in the area. And we didn't stay there very long, probably about 6 months. And this murder took place. And this was back in the 60s, late 60s. When I started writing, he suggested, why don't you write that murder up about our experiences, short experiences on Skid Row. So that's really what I did. And it's relevant today because Skid Row was an area of homeless people. Most of them were veterans from Vietnam. And it has relevance today because we're dealing with the homeless everywhere. So it has, I would say it's very relevant today.
Charlene Wexler will be my guest when we meet again. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.